Midnight's Children is the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club September selection, and Sir Salman Rushdie joins us now to discuss his book, which was awarded the Booker Prize in 1981, later voted the best of the Bookers, the best novel to be awarded a Booker Prize in the history of the prize, both in 1993 and again in 2008. The novel tells the story of Salim Sanai, born at the stroke of midnight on August 15, 1947, the exact moment of India's independence. His life and well-being is inextricably intertwined with that of his country. A 25th anniversary edition of Midnight's Children was published in paperback by Random House in 2006, and I'm very pleased that Salman Rushdie is here now to talk about his great novel. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, hello.
And we should point out that your latest book, Luca and the Fire of Life, has also been released in paperback by Random House.
Just came out, yeah.
We've received a lot of comments from listeners about how much they love the book. If you want to join the conversation, we invite you to leave a question about Midnight's Children on our show page at WMYC.org. Even better, you can give us a call at 646-829-3985. One of the trademarks of your writing is your colorful use of language, especially your mix of languages. Is this the language you grew up hearing?
It's a version of it, yes. I mean, one of the things that I felt when I was working on Midnight's Children is that a lot of the books that I had read in English, anyway, about India, were written in a very cool, Fausterian English.
English writers and Indian writers.
And Indian writers influenced by Forster. A Passage to India had a great impact, you know, in India. And I felt if there's one thing that India is not, it's not cool. You know, I mean, India is hot and noisy and crowded and excessive. And I felt that there was something inappropriate in that kind of cool prose. So I tried to find a kind of hot prose. I tried to find a sort of noisy, vulgar prose.
And you've come up with something that I guess has been labeled Hinglish. and readers figure it out.
Well, you know, Hinglish predates me. I mean, that's one of the things that is interesting about the way in which people use language in Indian cities is that they just very naturally jumble languages up. You know, everybody speaks more than one language, and you use the appropriate words. So quite often a sentence will contain words from other languages. Now, I mean, I don't do it a lot in Midnight's Children, otherwise it would become very confusing. But it did strike me reading novels by great New York Jewish writers like Philip Roth, that there's Yiddish sprinkled, untranslated, all over it. I mean, I remember reading a Roth novel in which somebody delivers a Zetz in the Kishkas. And I remember when I read it thinking, you know, what's a Zetz and where are Kishkas? And in the end I thought, well, I understand it. Clearly some kind of blow is being referred to.
To the gut.
Now I know, but then I didn't, you know. But I thought, well, if Philip Roth can do it, I can do it.
Well, you've also said that you, forgive me if I'm misquoting you, but I remember reading this a long time ago, that you felt that the use of English by writers throughout the Commonwealth has energized English fiction, which had kind of gotten rather dry and dull.
Well, I think, you know, America is the great exception to this, because I think post-war American literature is very rich.
We had Bellow and Malamud. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And Joe Heller. And I mean,
Ellison.
Yeah, all kinds of people. So I think this, but I do think that what had happened in English literature in the post-war period was that it just became a little bit less interesting. It was not that there were not great writers. There clearly were people like Muriel Spark and Iris Murdoch and Doris Lessing and so on. But I think what happened is that this new burst of writing coming from countries and cultures which had got English as a kind of consequence of the empire. You know, countries like, you know, the West Indies started producing great poets like Derek Walcott and writers like Naipaul, and Australia, great writing, South Africa, India as well. So suddenly there was this, it had to do with the globalization of the English language, that it became a globalized literature too.
Because people were writing English with another language in the back of their head.
Or with just a different use of English. You know, the way in which English is transformed in America. You know, English went through similar transformations in the West Indies or in South Africa or in Australia or in India.
The plot of Midnight's Children is quite complex. It follows your protagonist, Salim Sanai. Am I pronouncing his last name the way you would? and his family, but it also follows the shifting politics of India from a time before the independence of 1997 to 1997. Did you have to carefully plot it out before you started writing it?
To an extent, I did, yes. I mean, because, you know, the boy is born with the country as a sort of twin. And so I wanted to tell the story of both twins. And he also has this, I think, tragicomic conceit about himself that somehow he's responsible for history, that everything that happens because of him. So I knew that there were certainly a few big historical events that I wanted to work in.
And the twins, because India and Pakistan are really two parts of the same body, and that India is made up of Hindus and Muslims?
And Sikhs and Christians and all sorts of people. But I just thought that the kind of almost Bollywood idea of having a boy not just born at the moment of independence, but then the victim in the cradle at the hospital, the victim of a baby swap, you know, so he then acquires a life which is not really his life. That was just the given of the book. You know, that was the moment at which I thought of that. I sort of knew the book I wanted to write.
Many people would assume, because of the magic realism aspect, that your influences would be people like García Márquez and Borges. But you just said Bollywood. And I wonder how many Indian precedents were influencing you.
You know, first of all, I should say nobody called it Bollywood at the time. That's a more recent coinage. It was just the Bombay movies. But I grew up in Bombay, which is a big movie town. And as a result, yes, I think there's quite a lot of influence of the movies, both Indian and non-Indian. I've always been a big kind of movie freak. And people like Luis Buñuel, for example, were very influential on me, as was Fellini. I think Fellini's way of using childhood, for example, you know, to take the small details of childhood and to magnify them into almost grotesque proportions, I think was very inspiring when I was writing this book. And from India, of course, if you grow up in India, you have an incredible tradition of fabulous tales, which are your heritage.
But those fabulous tales don't, which involve magic and fantasy, mm-hmm. as does this book, don't also involve real politics and history, do
no.
they?
No, and truthfully, when
that's something that you... That just occurred to you?
It just came naturally, you know. I mean, I think if you grow up, as I did in that time, I mean, I'm a member of that generation that I'm writing about. It seemed inescapable to talk about the way in which public events impacted on private lives, because the impact was so great. And truthfully, people in India, you know, don't really read Midnight's Children as a fantasy novel. You know, they read it as a... I mean, not even a history book. They read it as an understatement.
But they must also be aware that although you have a reputation of being a very serious writer, your books are full of humor and fantasy.
Playful. I think it's funny. You know, I think one of the reasons why people go on reading Midnight's Children, you know, after all these years, and it had its 30th anniversary this spring, April the 6th, it was 30 years old. I think one of the reasons people go on reading it is that it's funny. You know, I mean, I mean, speaking as a reader, I don't really, certainly I don't go back to reading books that had no sense of humor.
Listeners have been writing in. Suzanne from Plainfield, New Jersey writes, "I just read this brilliant book this summer, and it struck me how much it influenced writers like Arundhati Roy and other South Asian writers. How do you feel about the influence that you've had on on other writers, and who are some of your favorites?"
Well, I'm very proud of the way in which Midnight Children did seem to, in its moment, it did seem to do something like opening a door through which this enormous, crowd of gifted Indian writers, Indian and Pakistani writers, has since come through. In the beginning, there was a sort of tendency people to try and write like Midnight's Children. There was a few imitations. But now, I think what's enriching now is that people have long gone past that, and the diversity of writers, you know, coming out of India is what's so great to see.
Tom in Astoria asks, after this many years since Midnight's Children's publication, how would you characterize your writing compared to a writer like Faulkner or Camus? How much is description and detail versus the poetic sound of the language important to you?
Boy, big question. Well, Faulkner, of course, had a very different had an advantage that I don't have, which is of being deeply rooted in one place, and was able to make a lifetime of work based on his tiny plot of land around Oxford, Mississippi.
Although he did spend a fair amount of time in Hollywood.
Yes, he did. Didn't like it, though. I've had a different kind of life experience, and that gives me a different kind of possibility, which is to root books and to root my imagination in different places. Camus, I've always felt a kind of fellow feeling for because he has a kind of quality of the migrant. You know, he has a family that came from North Africa, and he ended up very much at the heart of French literature. And I think there are books of his, like The Plague, for example, which are still astonishingly relevant today.
My guest is Salman Rushdie. His Midnight's Children, which is now 30 years old, is the subject of this month's Leonard LoPage Show Book Club. We invite your calls at 646-829-3985. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You talked about the immigrant experience. You were working in advertising in London when you wrote Midnight's Children?
Yeah, I was.
There are a few advertising slogans that appear in the book, like, "Does your chewing gum lose its flavor? But PK keeps its savor."
Yes.
And "Keep teeth clean and keep teeth bright. Keep teeth Colonos super white," all of those written with the kinds of misspellings we often see in ads. How much do advertisements reveal about a time and place and a culture?
Well, I think quite a lot, you know, and I certainly think when I was casting my mind back to the Bombay of my childhood, a very different city, smaller city, you know, than the giant kind of megalopolis that it's grown into.
Now called Mumbai for some reason.
Now called Mumbai by, yes, officially, although I think it's a little bit like calling Saigon Ho Chi Minh City. as far as I'm concerned, it's still Bombay. One of the things that came back to me when I was remembering that other Bombay of the 50s and 60s were a whole string of both radio. That Colinos toothpaste thing that you quoted was actually a radio jingle.
We Americans remember things like you'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
Exactly. I mean, I remember there's a pedestrian road bridge that goes over Marine Drive in Bombay by the edge of the water. And on one side, it had an Esso billboard which said, "Esso puts a tiger in your tank." And on the other side, it had a kind of anti-speeding message which said, "Drive like hell and you will get there."
Readers often look for autobiographical parallels in novels, and I'm sure they even find them when they're not there. But there are some similarities between Salim Sinai's early life and your own.
As I said, we're the same generation. I mean, I'm technically older than him. I mean, I'm 8 weeks older than him.
So you were born 8 weeks
before
the partition.
Yeah, I was born in June, and the partition and independence happened in the middle of August. So
now India and Pakistan celebrate different days, don't they?
Yeah, Pakistan's one day earlier. Pakistan's one day earlier, and that's more or less, ridiculously, it's for astrological reasons. It was the original independence date was going to be 24 hours earlier than it now is in India, but astrologers persuaded Jawaharlal Nehru that was an extremely inauspicious date. And he persuaded the British to postpone the independence of India by 24 hours. The Pakistanis were less impressed by astrology and said, "No, we're going to go ahead." You know, so the Pakistanis got their independence 24 hours before. And you could argue, based on the subsequent history of the two countries, that the astrologers were right.
Salim Sinai is, for a time, imbued with a magical power. He can get inside people's minds. What event triggers that power in him?
Well, the idea that I had was that this moment, the independence of India, was a moment of incredible hope, optimism. You know, it was the end of over two centuries of colonial occupation, so on. So the idea was to suggest that these children born at that moment of hope would be endowed with gifts which expressed that hope, if you like. So they became this magic generation from whom great things were expected and so on. And the tragedy of the novel, in a way, is the destruction of that hope.
Salim has a son born as the emergency is declared by Indira Gandhi 30 years later. So we have one child born in a moment of hope and another in a moment of
A much darker book, yeah. But the next kid, I mean, I wanted the end of the novel to suggest that there would be a next generation, you know, and in some way that next generation would be savvier, you know. It would have a kind of less... a less dreamy, less idealized idea of the world.
Do you think that's what's happening in India now during this time of economic boom? But well, not for everyone, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, that is true. I mean, I think that also what happens, of course, is that the generation of independence, the generation of Midnight's Children, was very much a transitional generation, you know, because the influence of the British was still very much there, you know, even though the British had left. Nowadays, that's much less the case. I mean, it's much more a genuinely Indian society.
I know this is a silly question to ask, but do you think if you were writing this book today, with all the things that have happened in your life and the fact that you left England and now reside in this country, that you would have written still a similar book?
I don't know. I'm just glad I wrote it then. You know? I mean, it was really difficult.
Well, were you feeling... You were working in advertising. A lot of creative people work in advertising. Mm-hmm. Almost every copywriter I ever knew was writing a novel, and mm-hmm. half the art directors were working toward their next show. But still, most of them don't wind up with a book like this.
Yeah. Well, I was lucky in that I managed to get a part-time job. I mean, I'd say in those days, advertising was more flexible in that way. And I ended up working a couple of days a week, which really meant that I had a way of paying the bills while I had 5 days a week to write. So it was actually, I mean, I thought of it like sponsorship, really. You know, but the moment the book was finished, I became incapable of continuing to work in advertising. I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, I mean, I'd always found it relatively, you know, easy to do and never miss deadlines and so on. And then suddenly when the book was finished, some switch flipped in my head and I couldn't do it anymore, so I quit.
Salim not only can read other people's minds, he finds out about his mother, for instance, and what her shopping trips are all about, which brings in a certain political aspect to the story. But he can also communicate telepathically with all the other children born during the midnight hour of August 15th, 1947. Mm-hmm. Do all these Midnight's Children have magical powers?
Yes, they all do. They all have different levels of magical powers, some of them very minor and some very important. And basically the idea is that the closer to midnight their birth time is, the greater are their gifts. So the children born in the first few seconds after the stroke of midnight are capable of extraordinary things, you know, sorcery and flying, and goodness knows what. But it's the idea is that all the children born in that first hour of independent India have some kind of gift.
And he convenes conferences in his mind.
Mm-hmm. He becomes the way in which they all come together. He's the one who can bring them together. And I think there's a moment in the book when you could ask yourself whether it's make-believe, you know, whether this is a lonely child inventing an imaginary world for himself, you know, and in the way that lonely children do. And that possibility, I think, gives it a little grounding in the possible, in what's naturalistic. And then I think later in the book you discover that actually, no, he's not making it up.
There is one other boy who stands out for him, also born at midnight, named Shiva.
Yes, the baby he was swapped with. Yeah. You know, and it's a rich and poor thing. So the poor boy, that's him, Salim, ends up in the rich family. And the real, you know, birth child of that family ends up as a kind of street hoodlum. And their rivalry and hostility towards each other is very much at the heart of the book.
Well, Shiva is also the name of a Hindu god.
Mm.
And we're talking about a Muslim boy and a Hindu boy. And although you don't write overtly about religion in this book, few of the characters are observant. But Salim's family is Muslim. And when they move to Bombay, his father's religion is a problem in just being able to conduct his business.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my family was one of the Indian Muslim families that did not wish to go to Pakistan, as you know, as many Indian Muslims did not.
But there was a huge migration, the greatest migration of ever.
No, there was a great migration. But if you think about it, there's still over 100 million Muslims in India, which is comparable to the population of Pakistan. So a very large number of people stayed behind and didn't want to go to Pakistan. And And yet there were problems. I mean, there were attempts to force Muslims in Bombay, in India, to give up their property and flee, and that certainly was something my parents had to fight.
The ethnic cleansing is what it's called now.
That's what it's called now. Yes, in those days there were other euphemisms.
My guest is Salman Rushdie. We're talking about his great novel Midnight's Children, which has won 3 Bookers. Is that possible?
Well, I mean, it does keep winning. I must say that the last one was very touching, because instead of being voted on by judges, it was a public vote. You know, and the idea that almost 30 years after a book comes out, an internet vote could vote for it. And, you know, internet vote by its nature is skewed towards young people. So the fact that these young people, many of whom would have been not born or only just born at the time that the book was born, still found it to be valuable, I think that was very pleasurable to me.
You mentioned that people who read it in India see this as perhaps an understatement. Is it still read a lot in India? Considering your own controversial history, has that colored the way people read you?
No, I think, you know.
Well, this book is just an entity in itself?
People like my stuff in India. I have to say, and people do, you know, Midnight's Children, I think people who read do read it. I mean, I think it's most people in India who you would think of as readers of novels would have read Midnight's Children, I think.
Roberta, one of our listeners, asks, is English your birth language, your mother tongue? And if not, how different would Midnight's Children have been if you'd written it in your birth language, from possibly having a smaller audience of readers?
No, my mother tongue is Urdu. Which is just sort of the language of Indian Muslims, or a lot of them anyway, in the north of India.
You spent a lot of time in Kashmir.
Well, my family's originally from Kashmir, yes. They had moved away before I was born, but we used to spend summers there. I could have written it in Urdu, I suppose, but it would have been, well, I'll tell you what would have been different. I mean, one of the big projects of this book is, as we were discussing earlier, a language project to create a language that sounds like, that has the rhythms of Indian language and Indian speech rhythms. And of course, if you were writing it in Urdu, that language project would no longer exist, because you would be writing in that language rather than trying to represent it in another language. So I don't know. I mean, these ifs, I don't know what to say. I mean, when I would write letters to my mother in Urdu, and she would write back and say how bad my Urdu had become. So I think really by the time I wrote Midnight's Children, I had no choice but to write in English.
Maria from Manhattan wrote this: I loved Fury and thought that you really got your relatively then newly adopted home. Now that you've been here much longer, would you have done anything differently in Fury? And do you plan any other New York City-based books?
No, I mean, I'm glad that you like that book, but because that was a novel very conscious of the fact that its author was a recent arrival, and so it was very much a novel of arrival. It was a novel of somebody coming to New York in the way, after all, that every day thousands of people come to New York.
Tomorrow we'll be talking to Carol Phillips, somebody else who grew up,
yes,
who was educated in England, as a Commonwealth citizen, about how immigration has changed since 9/11.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, this city is in many ways, you know, different since then. I don't know what I would do. I mean, I certainly have it in mind that I would write, you know, at least one, if not several more novels which have to do with New York, since, you know, I've been living here now for 12 years and it's where I spend most of my time.
Although it took Peter Carey something like 30 years before he wrote a book that even took place partly in New York City.
Yeah, he's Australian.
Salim's mother, Amina, stands up to an angry mob and protects a Muslim man. And was this happening a lot, crowds just going after Muslims?
In that moment of just before and just after the independence of India, there was an enormous amount of sectarian violence both ways round. There were Hindus being killed by Muslims being attacked, killed by Hindus. And so the country, you know, that I wrote, the independence that I write about, you have to say, was born it was a very bloody birth. You know, it was soaked in blood. And the stain of that is still there. One of the reasons for the great hostility between India and Pakistan is the legacy of the partition riots and the partition massacres.
And then what's still going on in Kashmir, and Salim's grandfather is from Kashmir. He loses his faith one day because of all the terrible things he's saying.
Well, I mean, it's a moment in the book, which is, again, people talk about autobiography. That's very, very unlike my own grandfather, who was quite a devout Muslim all his life. But I think it's not surprising, given the horror of the world, if people cease to believe in the existence of a good God. And that's what happens to him at a certain point in the book.
Barbara from New York City left this comment on our show page. She said, this is the most compelling book I read about 5 years ago, and still remember memory's truth, how it distills, alters, eliminates, how a human only trusts his own version of the truth.
I think that's true. I think memory is flawed, you know. I mean, the way in which you remember things is not always accurate. I remember, in my memory, I was in India at the time that India and China went to war in the early 60s. And I remember how people used to talk about it and the fears there were of a Chinese invasion. And then my parents, when I talked to my parents about this, my mother said, "Don't be silly, you were at school in England at the time." And when I looked up the dates, she was right. I hadn't been there. And yet, my memory insisted that I was. So I just decided with this book that it would be a book about memory rather than about truth.
And you allow Salim to be present at pretty much every major historical event in India. He's in more places than even Zelig was. The language marches, for instance. Can you explain what was happening there?
Well, there used to be what are now the two states of Maharashtra and Gujarat, around, of which the city of Bombay is sort of at the border of the two. That used to be one giant state, the state of Bombay, and there were agitations to divide the state into the two states that now exist, which were based on the fact that people speak Gujarati in Gujarat and Marathi in Maharashtra, and these so-called language marches became violent. And I thought, how strange it is, I thought, that people should actually go to war, start having street battles about linguistic chauvinism. At the time, that seemed very strange. Now, of course, unfortunately, in India, it's become more normal.
There's a screenplay that you've written, Midnight's Children.
Yeah, finally.
Are people planning to get into a film?
No, we've shot it.
Oh, you've shot it already.
Yes, yes. Deepa Mehta is the director, who made the wonderful film Water that was nominated for an Oscar a couple of years ago. Anyway, yes, I wrote the screenplay, we've filmed it, and we're in the process of cutting it. So this time next year.
Are you going to appear in it? Because you've been in Bridget Jones's Diary.
No.
And Then She Found Me.
No, I fired myself, actually. There was a part I'd always wanted to play, which was the part of the fortune teller who tells Salim's mother this bizarre fortune, which is essentially the plot of the novel. So I thought I should tell her the fortune. But then I thought, no, it would just be stunt casting and I shouldn't do it. So I fired myself.
Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children is available in paperback from Random House. Thank you so much for being on our book club today, and I'll be announcing the next book club in the next hour.
Thanks a lot.